why. But the other thing, on the pointing vector, isn't it E cross H star, E cross H conjugate defines P? Does that imply a 90 degree time relationship? I'm not sure about that. I know it's, but I think the pointing vector is E cross H star. Okay.
My understanding, John, is the E cross H star, where conjugate really means you're taking the complex number, which has got the R plus JX, so to speak. It's got what's the best way to explain this now? The way a complex number works is you've got the first component of the two, which is usually represented on the horizontal axis of an XY chart, and the second component is represented as the vertical axis, so that those axes are spatially on the way you draw the graph at 90 degrees to each other. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are temporally at 90 degrees from each other. I am convinced, with 98% assurance, that a true radiated wave, the E and the H field, in the far field, are exactly at 90 degrees from each other spatially. They're at 0 degrees from each other temporally. At the instant the E hits maximum, the H must hit maximum. And let me show you why it's got to be that way. And yeah, we can go back to Maxwell's equations and come up with a complicated looking answer that'll snow everybody. I'm going to have a very simplistic way of looking at this. Let me show you. Drop. One way that some people explain the pointing vector is that if I'm holding my hand out in front of me, my thumb is pointing in the direction of propagation, my fingers are straight up toward the ceiling, and they're in the direction of, in my example, for a vertically polarized wave, that's the E field. The E field on this vertically polarized wave is being represented by my fingers pointed up toward the finger, up toward the ceiling, and my thumb is pointing out in the direction of propagation. The H wave is, in my example, horizontal. So when I rotate my fingers around that thumb, in other words, I'm keeping my fingers out straight. I take the hold-on hand and rotate the hand so that now my fingers are off to the right, parallel to the earth, to the E field. That's one way it's been explained. As I rotate my hand from my fingers parallel to E toward my fingers parallel to H, keeping the thumb in the same direction, the advancement of a right-handed screw thread tells me the direction of propagation of that E crossed H operation that I just described. And if that happens to be true, let me drop, then in my mind there absolutely has to be E and H temporarily coincident, 0 degrees phase shift between the two. If it was like a LC network, where at one instant of time, an LC network, at the instant of peak voltage, all the energy is in the capacitor, and the inductor has just gone through zero current flow. And a quarter of a cycle later, all of the current flow is in the inductor, all the magnetic field is in the inductor, and the capacitor is going through 0 volts. So they flip back and forth between the two. If a electromagnetic wave did that, if at the instant the E was maximum, the H was going through zero, you have a real problem with the pointing vector. If I take that point in space where E has just gone through zero, I stop time, I stop the propagation, and I'm analyzing it. And I'm looking at, I've got this plane of observation where I've sliced the signal where the E has just gone through zero. If the H is at a maximum at that point, then if I slide my hand a little bit further downrange in distance of propagation, the E is negative. I slide my hand back. The E is positive, but it's going through zero at my point of observation. I have opposite polarities of E, a little bit forward and a little bit back from my point of observation where E went through zero. But H is at maximum throughout all of that. If that was true, then in front of the point of zero, my pointing vector would be toward me, and away from that point of zero, my pointing vector would be away from it. It'd have two different directions for the pointing vector. It wouldn't work. I can tell you for a fact, after a lot of experimentation, I'm firmly of the belief that the pointing vector of a real propagating wave is in one direction only. If I have a real wave propagating in space, the pointing vector tells me how strong is the wave, what direction...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
That pointing vector gives me two or three pieces of information. One, a direction of propagation. Two, a magnitude of the signal, the amount of energy per unit time of the signal propagating in that direction. Call it watts per square meter, call it joules per second, call it whatever you like. But the magnitude of the signal, the direction of propagation, in theory can be predicted from the pointing vector when you set it up correctly. And yes, it's probably E cross H star, E cross H conjugate. That's just to make the polarities and the mathematics work out right. But still, it is a kind of advancement of a right-handed screw thread. And from that point of view, E and H have to be time domain coincident, temporally coincident. Otherwise, the pointing vector breaks down, I think. That's what I believe, John. So the A2VDH, A2RIW.
Fine, this is Dick. You know what? I was just looking at it in terms of the curl, and I realized that the time derivative that's on the other side really becomes multiplication by J omega when you're dealing with sinusoidal steady state, and that's what the star takes care of, the conjugate. Takes care of that J when you do that curl E equal minus the partial B respected T. I just try to relate it back to the mathematics and in terms of the real world. But yeah, I can see what you're saying, and that seems absolutely right to me. Go ahead.
Hold on, Wes. Now, John, I wonder if you've run into the same problem I have. A certain number of textbooks, a certain number of people, a certain number of articles, a certain number of websites, a certain number of YouTube videos or whatever, firmly believe that the E and H of a propagating wave are 90 degrees spatially and 90 degrees temporally. They believe there's a phase shift between the two in the time domain. I think 20% of the textbooks have that backwards. I wonder if you've seen evidence of that, John. A2VDH, K2LIW.
Well, I'll tell you, Dick, there's a book I've been using quite a bit. It's a book by Cinema, William Cinema, Electronic Transmission Technology, and he in fact shows them at 90 degrees spatially, but he does show them peaking together. In other words, when the E field is maxed, the H field is maxed, and when you do the, you know, crossing E into H, to get the direction of propagation, it always comes out as being one direction. So a couple of books I've seen, I've only seen a book by Cinema, and it was another book I had a few years back that had it corrected. I haven't really seen it incorrectly. Go ahead.
Now, although this is extremely important in free space, I say it's almost equally important inside of a piece of coaxial cable. At each instant of time, at each micro-inch along the length of a coaxial cable, if there's only one wave propagating in one direction, you can measure the local E field, you can measure the local H field going around that center conductor in that TEM structure called coaxial cable. And once you know amplitude and phase angle of E and H, you know the direction of propagation if there's only one wave going in one direction. So even inside of a piece of coaxial cable, the pointing vector predicts and dictates an exact direction of propagation of that signal. It's kind of hard to believe that that signal continues to propagate in that direction until it hits some kind of a perturbation. And the craziness of a coaxial cable, similar to free space, let me drop, is that I can have a signal going from the input end to the output end of my coax cable. I can have a second signal going from the output end toward the input end of my coaxial cable, the same piece of coaxial cable. The signal flowing up the cable, the signal flowing down the cable, act as if they do not see each other. There's absolutely zero interaction between the two. That's a tough one to accept. Take my word for it, there's a lot of evidence that's true. The upgoing signal and the downgoing signal do not see each other. They're thoroughly separate. They each have their own individual pointing vector. Even if those two signals are on the exact same frequency and they came from the exact same signal generator, and the second signal is a reflection off of an imperfect antenna, those two signals are cupped completely independent of each other up to the point where something nonlinear happens in the cable. You've arced it over, and it's now a nonlinear plasma and whatever. Up until a nonlinearity occurs, the upgoing wave and the downgoing wave do not see each other. They're thoroughly independent events. The only time they become combined and they look like a so-called standing wave is with you and me in my slotted line. Let me drop. In my slotted line structure, which is the old way people used to measure this wire, I put a probe down in there, and that probe is a non-directional detecting device. The probe is sampling some of the signal going up, sampling some of the signal going down. The probe itself mixes the two signals together. They go into your crystal detector that's inside that probe, and now you look at what looks like peaks and valleys. You go to a certain point along the slotted line where the upgoing signal and the downgoing signal are in phase with each other, and you see a peak. You move a quarter of a wave downrange to where the upgoing signal and the downgoing signal are out of phase with each other, and now you see a valley, and we call that peak-to-valley ratio, and lots of people think there are peaks and valleys in that cable. Absolutely not. There's a signal going up, there's a signal going down, and your method of detecting made it look like there's peaks and valleys. There's two independent events passing through each other with no particular favored location, so to speak. There's a slight exaggeration in just what I said, but I think there's more truth than not truth in it. Lots of guys are going to have opinions on this one. K2RIW listening.
And to XCN. Dick, question. The inverse square law states that the energy content at a given area will increase as the square of the distance, and then it's considered to be the law, but consider that electromagnetic wave, as it propagates through the vacuum of space, spreads out in its width and the height, spatially, forming, let's say, cone-like projection. So as long as it propagates in a pure vacuum, all of the RF is conserved in wider and wider cross-section. So if you total up all of the RF spread out at the distance, the total energy would be the same as when it first left the radiating source. So from that perspective of its full diverging cross area, the total RF energy could be considered lossless, true or false.
I'm going to call that true as long as you consider it correctly. The word free space loss, L-O-S-S, creates an ambiguity, creates a misconception. Free space has no loss. I can take a 10 megawatt radar transmitter, transmit it a mile downrange, and I'm doing some sensing. I pick up a predictable amount of energy if I got a predictable number of square meters of receiving antenna a mile downrange. And because I know the range and the inverse square law and the radar range equation, I can tell you how many decibels of so-called free space loss you're going to measure. Well, if free space really had that loss, and if it really had conservation of energy, then the space in between those two antennas would be getting hot. It runs ice cold. Here's another way of looking at it. Let me drop. If I've got a 100-watt light bulb, old-fashioned incandescent light bulb in the middle of a spherical room, and I set the diameter of the room just right so that the room has 100 square meters of spherical area. And if the light bulb is a good isotropic source, 100 watts is radiated, each square meter of this room will get 1 watt of energy, 1 watt per square meter, because there's 100 square meters of the room. I now double the radius of the spherical room. Instead of it having 100 square meters, it's got 400 square meters. 4 pi r squared is the area of a sphere. Because I've got the same 100 watts, going across 400 square meters when I doubled the radius of the room. Each square meter is now going to get a quarter of a watt instead of 1 watt. Conservation of energy. The air in the room, in theory, as far as the real light wave is concerned, runs ice cold. Free space loss is not real loss. It appears to be a loss, but it really is not a loss. It's because you're covering more area when you're further distance away. Maybe that helps a little. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I understand that, like, let's say we have a coherent electromagnetic power source. Say we have a laser, okay? Like, very accurate laser. And it has almost no diversion, in theory. So, depending how can we have a frame of experiment defined, we have lossless electromagnetic waves around us. There is definitely something about I think that the analogy would be that, let's say we have two rooms, and in the center of the floor of the first room, I place the crisp new $10 bill. In the other room, I scatter $10 worth of pennies, one layer thick over the entire area of the floor. So if you compare the value taking up the cross area of the first room, $10 bill in the second room, you might count 10 pennies as a considerable loss. But if you scope up all of the currency in the second room, you can make the same purchases as you could with the money you found in the first room. So none of the money will be lost, just spread out. So there is definitely something to think about. Lossless electromagnetic waves are around us.
I did not understand that analogy, but I'm going to give you a much better one. When I talked about the inverse square law, I talked about the 100 square meter area, spherical room, and then twice the radius of room, twice the diameter, 400 square meters, and the 1 watt per square meter in the first case, a quarter watt per square meter in the second case. That is true if and only if the source is isotropic, and if and only if I'm in the far field of that radiating system. Let me show you the exception. If I took my laser pointer and I put it at the eyepiece of my telescope, and my particular Cassegrain telescope has got an 8-inch diameter to it, and now if I set things up correctly, the whole 8 inches of the diameter of the telescope is emitting that signal. And if I focus the telescope at infinity, I'm now issuing a planar wave at the surface of the output of that telescope. My telescope is acting as a collimator. That beam coming out of the telescope, I could measure the watts per square meter across the 8-inch diameter right at the mouth of the telescope. I could measure it 10 feet away, 100 feet away, maybe even a mile away, and I'll measure the exact same number of watts per square meter. The inverse square law will look like it's being violated. Let me drop. There's a catch. And the catch is the 8-inch diameter telescope at optical wavelengths has a so-called near-field range, 2D squared over lambda, of I think it's 97 miles. In other words, except for air scattering and other aerosols and other things giving me a problem, when you're in the near field of a large diameter collimator, so that the signal coming out of there really looks like a tube of energy and there's very little divergence to it, you now violate the inverse square law. You double the distance, you do not get one quarter of the power. You'll get a slight decrease, but very little. That's because you're inside of the near field of that emitter. Inverse square law only works if you're in the far field of the emitter, and if the emitter in your direction appears to be isotropic. Well, a flashlight in that particular direction could appear to be isotropic if I'm careful with how I make the measurement, only at the bore site of the flashlight, if you know what I mean. So, inverse square law. There are lots of places where you violate it, but you're not violating physics when you do it. You may be misunderstanding near field. I wonder if that makes a little bit of sense. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Oh, it does. Definitely does. What I was trying to say is that if you have this word, which you said, is perfectly spherical room, and you just send the energy from the middle of it, that energy, let's say, in ideal situation, could not go anywhere. It stay within the room. So basically, it's in line with whatever you're saying. But I have something really what puzzles me, and I was trying to explain it, but my wording is still not perfect enough to say it. Let's say we have, so whatever is incorrect in English, would you please just try to get out of it something? Let me just... Whenever you have the H field and you disturb the H field by motion, you're creating E field. So E and H are the properties of the electromagnetic wave, of light as well. Now, if we're dealing with the static magnetic field from the magnet bar, if we create a motion to H, now creating E field, so we move the bar. Now, question is, are we dealing with the static E when we have a static electromagnetic field of the bar magnet? And again, the question I repeat, why the magnetic field of the bar magnet is not consumable and to exist?
I think a bar magnet sitting on the table with no motion has a beautiful, predictable magnetic field, B field, H field, call it whatever units you like, steady state magnetic field. I believe there is no E field there. When you move it by plunging it into that coil of wire, you're generating an E field. It is my belief, I'm going to ask a couple of people this one, mechanically I know I can't do it, but if I had the resources to move that magnet back and forth along its axis, if I could move it fast enough at, let me pick a number, 3.5 million times per second in a sinusoidal manner, I think I would be generating a 3.5 megacycle electromagnetic wave. I'm not positive, but I think I would. Mechanically, I can't do that. But if I could, I think I would generate a weak 3.5 megacycle electromagnetic wave. Anybody got an opinion on that one? K2LIW?
KFBDH?
KC2QIQ.
Don and Glenn in that order. John first, go ahead.
I think you would. As a matter of fact, I was just thinking about that similar question. If you took a bar magnet and spun it, say, at a more reasonable speed, say at 30,000 RPMs, and it wouldn't fly apart. A bar magnet rotating at 30,000 revolutions per second, it might fly apart. Would you be able to pick it up on my old RBA5 receiver at 30 kilohertz? And yes, I think you would be able to hear it. I think the time varying magnetic field would generate a spatially varying electric field, and which goes back, couples to the magnetic field, and that makes the electromagnetic wave. Go ahead.
Now, John, I think you just created a much more reasonable way of doing it mechanically. If I took this bar magnet and I choose the mass center of the bar magnet and put a pivot shaft through there, and now I rotate the magnet so that the North Pole is starting off at 12 o'clock, going toward 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. The South Pole is starting at 6 o'clock, going 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. I'm rotating it in that way. I'm now, in my mind, generating a circular polarized electromagnetic wave. I've got a moving magnetic field, happens to be in a circular manner instead of a linear manner. Nothing wrong with that. I can make a circular polarized wave. And now, mechanically, I stand much more of a chance of doing it without it flying apart. and I can spin it without taking a megawatt of mechanical energy to do it. In theory, I can now spin that magnet with watts of energy. I only have to worry about the air resistance and whether or not the centrifugal force will make it fly apart. I think I can generate a circular polarized wave that way. And now, whether I decide to use... Let me drop... Whether I decide to use a CP antenna or a linear antenna to pick it up, that's a minor detail. I think that will radiate a real wave. I don't think it's going to be a very strong wave. I can't make it at a very high frequency without it flying apart, but I think it will work. Let's see what Glenn thinks. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I've brought this topic up a couple of times and had no takers, but it sounds like tonight we are a little bit more receptive. So I'm going to go over a couple of items here. If you have a magnet and you're rotating it, or if just sitting on a bench and it's not moving, and you take a piece of copper wire, and that copper wire, and you move it into the field so that you're cutting the lines of flux at 90 degrees. In other words, just taking a piece of wire and you put some kind of a voltmeter or a galvanometer or something across it just so that you can see the deflection. The only difference between how much deflection that you're seeing is the distance and sensitivity of your meter. In other words, what I'm pointing out here is that those lines of flux reach out far beyond that magnet than you can imagine. They continue out almost really forever. That field, it's just that the magnetic lines of flux are very, very weak the further you're getting away. So when you're rotating this magnet in free space and you're putting an antenna way off in the distance, the only thing that's really different is the distance, how close you are to the magnet. So what are we really saying here? We're saying, okay, is the wire 1 inch from the magnet, 5 inches from the magnet, a mile from the magnet? The result is the same. Let me let's drop for a second. When we talk about voltage, current, flux intensity, and H for path length, we have Ohm's law that tells us that if you have a voltage, in order to measure that voltage, you have to generate a current in order to know that you have a resistance. So in the equation, without it being discontinuous, you're always implying if there's an open circuit voltage, there must be at least some minimum current flowing and some very, very high impedance. So we always know that there's a voltage, but we're assuming if there's voltage there, there's got to be some current, even if it's leakage, whatever it might be. For the voltage to be there, there must be a current, which means that there must be some high resistance. That being said, if there's some very, very light current, just say that there's some voltage applied there, you're also implying that current has, right-hand rule, a B field around whatever that current is. Maybe extremely weak, but it's there. So the idea is that, yes, these signals might be very, very weak and off in distance, but they are being generated. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I see an exception to that one, Glenn. You believe that magnetic field from that bar magnet sitting on that table generates a field that falls off very rapidly with distance, inverse square law or cube law. Magnetic fields sometimes fall off cube laws, but we won't go into those minor details. The signal gets weaker and weaker. I defy you to come up with reasonable instrumentation that can detect the magnetic field of that particular bar magnet of mine 1 mile away. And if you can do it at 1 mile, I know you can't do it at 10 miles. So at 10 miles away, I don't think there is any reasonable instrumentation. I don't care if you're using squibs and flux gate detectors, whatever. The most sensitive magnetic detector is not going to detect that magnetic field 10 miles away. But yet I can take the B field magnitude of that magnet, make that the peak B field coming out of my real antenna, and maybe my antenna is at 2 meters, but I make the B field coming out of that antenna, measured in its far field, equal to the magnetic field of that bar magnet. But I'm now transmitting a real electromagnetic wave. That signal 10 miles away in free space is going to be 100 decibels above threshold. That magnetic field, with any reasonable instrumentation, is going to be 50 decibels below threshold. I'm using this as an example. I think there's some kind of magic of an electromagnetic wave in the way it propagates which is significantly different than a pure steady-state magnetic field. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
There's absolutely no disagreement in what you're saying right now to what my comments earlier. And basically what's happening is that we're talking about signal-to-noise ratio. There's always a certain amount of noise to the background, and there's signal. So in other words, the ability to measure a signal at a very, very far distance, you're correct that your signal-to-noise ratio for your instrumentation to get a deflection would be so polluted by other noise around the outside that you'd never be able to see it. That's really the issue here. So the idea is, okay, how can you create a better signal-to-noise ratio? Well, we know as ham radio operators that resonance and increasing the Q of circuitry allows us to do that. So if you have an electromagnetic wave at a frequency and you have an antenna cut to a resonant frequency, now you've improved your ratio of signal to noise so that at a further distance you can measure the signal. I don't think there's any real magic here, Jack. K2RIW, KC2QIK.
I'm seeing a degree of truth in what you're saying, Glenn, and that is if I make that magnetic field operate at, in my example, 2 meters, 146 megacycles, and because I can devise an antenna specializing 146 megs for the reception, and I connect that to a receiver with a finite bandwidth, and right now I'm listening to you with a 15 kilohertz noise equivalent bandwidth receiver, whereas detecting that pure steady state magnetic field at DC, I have no real frequency selectivity there. What you're saying is a whole lot of noise. However, you allow me to turn on and off that magnetic field from that bar magnet, because my bar magnet is now an electromagnet, and I'm putting a square wave into it, and I'm turning on and off the square wave at, let me pick a number, 1 kilohertz. So I'm making 1 kilohertz square waves of magnetic field, and by way of my telephone circuit, I'm transmitting the synchronization of the 1KC square wave over to your house 10 miles away, so that now you are building a thoroughly synchronous demodulator, and you know the exact frequency and you know the exact phase of my modulation because I've told you over that telephone circuit, for instance. So now you've got an exact wavelength, exact frequency, exact synchronous demodulation. A properly set up synchronous demodulator does cancel noise by zillions of dB. You can easily get 50, maybe 100 dB of noise cancellation by synchronous demodulation. So now I run this 1KC square wave modulated signal, and I'm giving you the exact information as to how to demodulate it. I still say that 10 miles away, with the best detectors you can...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
With the best detectors, magnetic detectors that you can come up with, flux gate, squibs, whatever, cryogenically cooled, use whatever detector you can. And I'm telling you exactly when the signal is on, when the signal is off, and you're doing full wave synchronous demodulation, canceling all noise components that are not completely synchronous with that 1KC wave. I still say 10 miles away, you will not measure that magnetic field. I still say there's something magic about a true electromagnetic propagated wave that goes through space in a way that really propagates the energy differently than a pure steady-state magnetic field, even with this modulation technique I just given to you. I don't think you're going to detect that 10 miles away, no matter what you use. KC2QIQ. I challenge you on that one, Glenn. K2RIW.
Comment.
Yeah, the comment is recognized. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying at all, Dick. It's the only point that I was making in the original discussion is that the only real difference is in the distance from the static field is the intensity as you're moving away. And what's happening is, as you said before, one of the differences with that intensity is that you have a cube, a cubing problem. That, in other words, instead of having inverse square, you basically have an inverse cube. So in other words, what's really happening is that signal, when by the time you get 10 miles away, is extremely light. That's one of the issues there. inverse square law, you already have an advantage just to that alone. Plus, there's the other thing. You added modulation on top of that. Modulation is another improvement. If you were just to have a dead carrier and you're going to detect it in the weak field distances, it becomes hard to detect. But put CW tone and modulate on top of it, and it makes it that much easier to detect. So modulation, having inverse square law versus inverse cube law, and then, of course, the advantage of modulation, all of which make improvements from just the static magnetic field. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I think there's a breaking station in there, Dick.
Yeah, that was John who's going to give us a comment, but there's something we got to go through here first, Glenn. The magnetic field that's part of an electromagnetic wave, there's a real E field, there's a real H field. The magnetic field portion or the E field portion, whichever I want to analyze, falls off with inverse square law of energy. E field falls off linear with distance, by the way. If I'm just measuring peak E field voltage during a electromagnetic compatibility, during a susceptibility measurement. So E field and H field fall off energy-wise of the total wave square law. E field, when measured from a electromagnetic compatibility, a EMI measurement, falls off linear. Why does magnetic field fall off cube law? And is that the reason why the electromagnetic wave can easily be detected at 10 miles, but the magnetic wave, no matter how I do noise canceling, no matter how I do bandwidth limiting, you and I could set up a measurement, Glenn, where I'm modulating the magnetic field at a 60-cycle square wave, correction, a 1kc square wave rate, 50% duty cycle, 1kc square wave. I could run that experiment for a solid hour if I integrate with a synchronously modulated for a solid hour. My noise equivalent bandwidth of that system is millihertz or microhertz. I've now limited the bandwidth. It's still with all of that advantage of exact synchronization, exact synchronous demodulation, and a noise equivalent bandwidth of millihertz or microhertz. With all of that advantage, you're not going to detect that magnetic field. An electromagnetic wave of the exact same magnitude as a point of generation 10 miles away, you'll detect it in free space, 100 dB above threshold. What's going on there? And why does that magnetic field fall off with the cube law? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Well, let's start with the EMI measurements. Most of the EMI measurements that I'm familiar with, at least anyway, are done at calibrated distances. In other words, they're generally of a point source or unit under test in investigation, and it's like either in a 10-meter type of chamber or a 3-meter type of chamber. So the field distance is a fixed distance well within near-field type of measurements, and the distance from the unit under test to the test antenna and its gain, there is a linear relationship associated to that chamber and the way that the measurement is set up with an analyzer. So when we're talking about fixed transmitter over long distances, we're in deeply into the inverse square law, because we're at a distance at that point where we're beyond the near field measurements and we're measuring electromagnetic waves in the inverse square law proportion as it's falling off. The static magnetic field to a fixed magnet sitting there on the desk with no motion basically has a B field, and the B field can be calculated in terms of flux intensity. And if you were to measure flux intensity over distance, in other words, if you were to start at a starting point, in other words, put a current into a wire and measure and clamp around it and find out what the current in the wire is, and then start measuring the flux intensity either in Tesla or Gauss as you start moving away, there's going to be a cube root fall off due to the amount of lines of flux that are generated associated to distance. That's a completely different ratio than inverse square law. So there is a steep advantage to inverse square law in the far field as opposed to a fixed cube law that's falling off just due to simple lines of flux running from the north to the south pole of the magnet. KC2QIQ.
John, we haven't forgotten you. Let me run it by you again, Glenn. And maybe there's another interpretation here. From an antenna man's point of view, when I'm in the far field of an antenna, without a doubt, the energy always falls off by inverse square law. Double the distance, you get one quarter of the energy in watts per square meter, power flux density, in the far field. In the reactive near field, I can get inverse, not square law, cube law, quadruple law, penti law, six, hexi law, or whatever. So are we saying that when you measure H field in a electromagnetic compatibility environment, that it falls off most of the time by cube law because from an antenna point of view, I'm inside of the reactive near field of the equivalent of that antenna that's generating that magnetic field? Is that why it falls off cube law? And if I get far enough away, does it keep falling off by cube law, or does it eventually go to square law? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
You got to be confused. Now, are we talking about static field of a magnet, or just a current with just DC wire in it, or are we talking about a measuring a magnetic B field with an antenna? Because when you said measuring an H field, I'm not sure that electromagnetically you can measure an H field. You can measure a B field, but an H field is that's kind of like a path length in Oersted. So I'm a little confused here what we're actually trying to measure.
I may have used the wrong letter and the wrong concept. If I'm measuring the external magnetic field being leaked from a 60-cycle power transformer, yeah, I've seen lots of evidence that the leaking magnetic field at a 60-cycle rate coming off a transformer tends to follow a cube law. If I get far enough from that transformer, does a cube law become a square law? Or is it a cube law in the magnetic field falling off from that transformer? Does that hold a mile away? KCQQIQ, K2LIW.
Magnetic flux intensity B will follow cube law. And the reasoning there is because if you were to look at flux intensity, or basically field lines of flux. So in other words, normally you have a source that's generating your magnetic field, whether it be a magnet, usually, or a coil, or something, or a hunk of wire, or your transformer per se, whatever your unit of test is that you're measuring as your generating source. There's a fixed line, a field line of flux from, you could define a north and a south in that area, and if you were measuring flux intensity B from that source, those field lines have a very, very predictable density as it moves away from that source, and that happens to be inverse cube to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I've got another problem. Assume I'm using an extremely fine grain mu metal of some kind that has reasonable efficiency at 3.5 megahertz. So I've made a transformer, and it can operate at 3.5 megahertz of voltage going into its primary winding. And that particular high-quality, very fine-grained transformer has some external magnetic field at a 3.5 megacycle rate. And alongside of that, I've got my 3.5 megacycle dipole antenna. And I think if I'm smart enough, I can make the magnetic field magnitude coming out of the transformer be approximately equal to the magnetic field radiated by my 80-meter dipole when I put the right power into the two. I think I can make the magnetic field out of the two at a 3.5 megacycle rate in both cases be very similar. Now, I'm reasonably sure that as I back away from the 3.5 megacycle dipole antenna, I'm going to get a certain rate of fall off of the magnetic field component of that electromagnetic wave. By the same token, when I back away from the 3.5 megacycle transformer, I'm going to get a certain rate of fall off of those magnetic fields. Tell me about the rate of those two fall offs. Are both of them cube law, Is one of them cube law and one of them square law? Is one of them linear? KCQQIQ, K2LIW?
Okay, to the best of my knowledge, Dick, when we're talking about a dipole antenna, and you're going to be using some kind of a receiver, and I would imagine your receiver is going to be like a spectrum analyzer. And as you're moving away from the far field, we're going to be talking about inverse square law. Inside the far field, we're going to be getting all kinds of nodal response and other kinds of good stuff happening around the antenna, where we're going to be probably not quite inverse square law. We're going to be something different. Up to a certain distance, and I'm not sure if that's where it gets a little gray for me in that, but that's all basically looking at E field. But if we have an H field detector, a B field detector, and that device could still be used with the spectrum analyzer, but there's a conversion factor for that. The B field is still going to fall off at the fixed inverse cube, and that's mainly because the flux intensity lines are still the same flux intensity lines, regardless of, unless, of course, there's like nodal interference in between, which is rare, or something is interfering in between. But that's pretty well represented. Usually the magnetic will fall off into a magnetic device. But if you really can't use a dipole to measure magnetic field, or at least I don't know of any conversion factor that would allow you to measure flux intensity with a dipole antenna and a spectrum analyzer. Not at least off the top of my head, the K2IW, KC2QIQ.
What would you use for B-field detector?
It's been done, Glenn. There are people who have taken a Hall effect device, reasonably well shielded as far as E-field is concerned, but H-field was passing through the Hall effect device, and they held it near a dipole antenna. I can measure the magnetic field in the vicinity of the wire of a dipole antenna with a Hall effect device.
Is it A to E to always be?
I can take the exact same Hall effect device, and I can hold it near that transformer. I can now slowly back away from the dipole antenna with a Hall effect device. I can back away from the transformer with a Hall effect device. They're both measuring the strength of a magnetic field at a 3.5 megacycle rate. Things like that have been done. Will one of them fall off at square law and one of them fall off at some other rate? What's your prediction on that? And if you're not sure, I'll understand that. This is a crazy experiment. I don't remember the results, but some of it has already been done. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Trying to let it reset. The Hall effect device is definitely one of the methods used for measuring B fields. It can definitely be done. There are also, Wesley, other devices that look like donut-shaped devices. There's also devices that look like huge rings, especially if you've got to do large field intensity measurements. I've seen things that look like structures that are like 6 foot high, 6 foot wide, big squares with heavy-duty wire around the outside. There's a lot of different setups to be used that can be used to measure B field. Using a wire length like that appears like a dipole with a fixed Hall effect device, yes, that measurement can also be done there. There again, there's also calibration techniques that have to be used to calibrate the from a fixed known source. So depending on who sets up the test, those can be done so that you accurately measure fixed lines of flux. But lines of flux and field intensity of lines of flux is defined as inverse cube law, as far as to the best of my knowledge, Dick. And that's just mainly due to how field intensity of B fields roll. Electromagnetic E field is a little bit different with inverse square law beyond the near field. But I think what happens is at the distance at which a magnetic field intensity starts to roll off, it becomes very, very difficult to detect any kind of flux intensity field, so you're really only seeing the E field component after the far field distances. Hope that makes a little bit more sense there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I see your problem. I've read enough people who have made the measurement with Hall effect devices and other kinds of magnetic detectors in the vicinity of a leaking transformer. And so many times it's been said that in many cases I'm believing it's true that the magnetic field external to a transformer at the transformer's operating rate, which might be 60 cycles, might be 400 cycles, whatever, tends to fall off cube law with distance. Now, I know when it comes to making a measurement in the far field of an antenna, where I'm measuring volts per meter of E field or amps per meter of magnetic field, I know that volts per meter falls off linear with distance. Amps per meter falls off linear with distance. What's magic about an antenna that makes those two things fall off linear with distance, but yet the leakage magnetic field around a transformer falls off cube law with distance? What's going on here, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
.4NI over the path length LE. What's happening is geometrically, you have to draw the path length from the source back. So what's happening is as you're moving away, you have a linear drop in N or I, okay, in that particular length as you're moving, and of course in that any length of N, which represents one turn at a distance, so your antenna is a unit of one, and so in other words, now you just basically E and I at that particular time, so you're always working at one. The problem with the reason why the magnetic is dropping off the cube is because of the path length. You always for each unit of length outward, you basically have the 3.14 arc dividing in the LE on the bottom. KC2QIQ.
Okay, let me reword it. What's different about the path length of the magnetic field, the leakage around the transformer, versus the path length of the magnetic field in the far field of an antenna? One of them falls off cube law, one of them falls off linear. How did the path length difference make that 3-to-1 ratio? I won't call it a 3-to-1 ratio. A cube law versus a linear law. How did that conversion take place as a function of path law? What's magic about the path length around the transformer? What's magic about the path length around the antenna? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Geometry of the two paths. One path, as you described earlier, is holding off the inverse square law in the EM wave, in the wavefront, where you're always looking for an E signal, the E signal that you're measuring on your spectrum analyzer through a resonant length of an antenna. So that's always falling off an inverse square law because of the wavefront action of how a wave is being displaced in free space from distance from the radiator. The path length, if you were to draw the arc, is not in the same linear vector as the electromagnetic wave. You have a path length that's a circle that starts from where the path is starting from the point source, circulating out in the same direction as the wavelength, but then returning back to the source. So as you're moving out, that circle is getting larger and larger and larger and larger, and the field of flux intensity lines are thinning by the cube root geometrically as that circle is getting larger as the wavelength. Think of the wavefront as the radius and the path length as the circumference as you're moving out. Does that make sense?
Not yet. You and I have created a problem. Maybe I've created a problem. We've got an apples and orange problem here. We're mixing apples and oranges. Let me show you what I mean by that. To a electromagnetic compatibility engineer, he measures E field in volts per meter. He measures magnetic field in amps per meter. He states that in the far field of an antenna, the E field falls off linear. Double the distance from the antenna, the volts per meter goes to 1/2.
just started transmitting. I think there were